1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, a posthumous look through voices of David Bowie and Mick Ronson at the album which changed the trajectory of rock music, fashion, and gender issues in just 38 minutes.
Freak out in a moon age daydream, oh yeah. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds.
So come on, come on. You really got a good thing going.
I think that the person that I was listening to out of America as much as Little Richard by that time would have been Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground.
I'm down, thank you, man.
And so that, you know, those are sort of both ends of where I was at, from Lou Reed to Scott Walker. And then all these other weird things in between, you know, everything from sort of avant-garde movies to bits of theatre that I caught, Harold Pinter, Kabuki Japanese theatre. It was a ball of knotty string. and there were all these threads running through all of culture, and it didn't really matter which art form it came from, that I felt could be developed for record and stage and make rock something other than what it was at the time. Hi, this is David Bowie, and I'm in the studio for the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
At the time of its release in June 1972, the Ziggy Stardust made David Bowie into the hottest rock star on the planet. It was the beginning of glam rock's heyday, a record and success story based as much on Bowie or Ziggy's persona as it was on the music. In fact, most of the attention then in the British press was focused on things other than music: Bowie's clothes, his sensuality, the outrageousness of it all. But it's likely that all the hype, all the packaging, would have been wasted if the music hadn't been so good. Rolling Stone magazine put the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars in the number 35 spot in its top 500 albums of all time. They didn't do it because of David's hairstyle. This was powerful music, a more successful combination of the elements of theater and rock that had ever been attempted. As a rock fable, the story of stardom and its capacity for self-destruction, it worked much better than The Who's Tommy.
It all gets rather complex, actually. I think that the person that I was listening to out of America as much as Little Richard by that time would have been Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. They were incredibly important to me. I was lucky to get to hear them very early on. I got to hear them before the Americans did. A friend of mine brought back from America, he knew Warhol, and he paid a trip over to New York, and Warhol gave him an acetate of this band that he'd just sort of been involved with, and said, you know, see what you can do with this for British, see if you can get this a release in England on some label. And the guy came back and said, listen, I found this really crappy piece of work that Warhol gave me. It's all noise. There's no songs on it. And like a fool, he gave it to me, and I got a whole new lease on life. Mm. I thought, this is really cool. I want to sound like this, but English. So it sort of, that became part of my major influences at that time. Also, on top of that, at the other end of the pole, an American singer called Scott Walker, who'd abandoned America and had come to live in Britain. And he had two guys with him, and they called themselves the Walker Brothers.
The Walker Brothers were American?
The Walker Brothers were from Southern California.
I had no idea. I always thought they were British. How about that?
And so, that, you know, those are sort of both ends of where I was at, from Lou Reed to Scott Walker. And then all these other weird things in between, you know, everything from sort of avant-garde movies to bits of theatre that I caught, Harold Pinter, Kabuki Japanese theatre. It was a real complex, it was a ball of knotty string. And there were all these threads running through all of culture, and it didn't really matter which art form it came from, that I felt could be developed for record and stage and make rock something other than what it was at the time. More representative of what contemporary culture felt like, I guess. That was, you know, it's kind of art with a big A.
Gotcha.
I suppose.
Yeah.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, and her mommy is yelling no, and her father has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen as she walks through a sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view. And she's hooked to the silver screen, but the film is a saddening bore, 'cause she's lived it 10 times or more. It's about to be lived again as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Those cavemen go. It's the freakiest show. Take a look at the lawman beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know. He's in the best-selling show. The life on Mars. Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clowns. But the film is a saddening bore, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be read again as they ask me to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's the freakiest show. Take a look at the lawman beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know. He's in this best-selling show. Is there life?
When Rolling Stone magazine listed their top 500 albums of all time, David Bowie's third album, Hunky Dory, was listed at an impressive 108. Bowie himself pointed to it as significant in his development as a songwriter.
I think, interestingly enough, the one thing that Maybe I learnt from doing Hunky Dories that how oriented I was toward narrative, and that I had a natural inclination to develop little scenarios and characters. Even though there were no real characters on Hunky Dory, the idea of developing little story songs as opposed to sort of just mood pieces, it obviously was quite strong in me. And I think it gave me the motivation to propel myself towards something that was a lot sort of more cohesive as an album, that virtually took one storyline and developed it and gave it different moods. So it might have been Hunky Dory probably for me was a first recognition that I had this ability to write stories that people found interesting. Yeah, that's probably more than anything else.
Okay.
Of course, it also cemented a real good relationship with Mick Ronson on that album. We'd started working together on an album before, Man Who Sold the World. But we really sort of realised that we were collaborating in a very strong way. So that was a great thing that came out of Hunky Dory. Yeah. I do remember that. At that period, I was releasing two albums a year. I mean, it was nothing to release two albums a year at that time. I find work not easy, but really satisfying. And I think when you enjoy something that much, you kind of do it as much as you can. Bit like sex, Redbeard.
Throughout his illustrious career, David Bowie exhibited a keen ear for guitarists, starting with a gardener from the northern English county of Yorkshire named Mick Ronson.
We kind of looked like brothers or something because we both had long blonde hair, you know. We also had like a similar sort of look, you know. We kind of looked like brothers or something, you know. So that's how come Hunky Dory sounds acoustic, because it went from the numbers being done as an acoustic sort of duo to bringing in a bass player and a drummer again, which was like Trevor and Woody, you know. Then it started to get more electric because there was more of a band there all the time. So then when we got to Ziggy Stardust, it was like the band with Woody and Trevor, but it was much more electric again because we'd gone through the acoustic thing, because we still wasn't doing the acoustic thing, so it moved back to electric because of the bass playing and drumming all the time. So that's how come them albums sounded really sort of different, you know.
I'm an alligator, I'm a mama, papa coming for you, I'm the space invader, I'll be a rock and rolling bitch for you, keep your mouth shut, just squawk like a big monkey bird, and I'm busting up a brain for the world.
tell you one quite amusing thing maybe about Mounet's Daydream. The solo in it is a baritone, and it was supposed to have been fife, but we couldn't find anybody that played fife. So I think I ended up playing penny whistle. So it's baritone, sax, and penny whistle.
Wow.
And I got that combination of instruments from, dig this, the B-side of the Hollywood Argyles' Alley Oop. On the other side was a song called Sure Know Lot About Love.
Wow.
And the solo of that was fife and baritone sax. And I thought, that is the greatest combination of instruments. It's so ludicrous.
Wow.
You got this tiny little sparrow of a voice on top and this huge grunting pig ox of a thing at the bottom. I do remember that. At that period, I was releasing two albums a year. I mean, it was nothing to release two albums a year at that time. That's, I don't know, I find work not easy, but really satisfying. And I think when you enjoy something that much, you kind of do it as much as you can. Bit like sex, Redbeard.
The R&B rage that Bowie found himself swept up in was the same English primordial musical swamp that spawned the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Who, and the Yardbirds, with first Eric Clapton, then later Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page.
It was a very exciting period in Britain because all the blues artists would come. There was this sort of upsurge because of bands like the Stones and Yardbirds, and they'd sort of revived this incredible interest in blues and rhythm and blues. And so artists who weren't working too much in the States were flooding over to Britain and really working out over there, going up and down Britain to all the major cities and getting themselves, suddenly all their careers had been reignited.
Mm-hmm.
It was fantastic to be able to see Muddy Waters and Jimmy Witherspoon, Jimmy Reed and Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee and all these guys. It was just unreal.
Mm-hmm.
Here they all were, virtually all playing up one street in London.
Wow.
Every night of the week for like months. It
Wow.
was just like, it was heaven for us, you know.
Up next, David Bowie reveals how his very British perspective was refracted through a very American prism. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit inthestudio.net for many more exclusive interviews and live performances. I'm Redbeard with David Bowie in the studio, the iconic The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Hi, this is David Bowie, and I'm in the studio for The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Missing that man tremendously. I'm Redbeard, and difficult for Americans to imagine the post-war England into which the members of the Beatles, Rolling Stones, and yes, David Bowie were born and raised. There was no proliferation of hundreds of independent local radio and TV stations like in the U.S. Rather, there was one national radio station, the BBC, which would play youth-oriented R&B and rock and roll records a grand total of 1 hour per week. Through these brief glimpses of America and the occasional Hollywood movie, David Bowie imagined an idealized version of the American dream.
It definitely was the land of milk and honey for me in a creative way. I was introduced to the American writers and jazz musicians really when I was very young, I guess. When I was kind of 9, 10, I was given books on Jack Kerouac and Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg and Corso and all that whole beat crowd.
Right.
And they became sort of early Bibles for me. And because of their books, I got into jazz and Eric Dolphy and the whole Coltrane thing. And a lot of it I never really quite understood, but the feeling in there was enough to move me toward thinking that America is the place where real breaking away can happen, where you can really go after a kind of a dream, you know. And then because of the jazz, naturally I discovered blues and rhythm and blues and all that. So it opened up so many avenues for me in ways that one can express oneself. So those were the early things. And it wasn't until much later I realized that all the things that I loved, Jimmy Dean, blue jeans, well, not blue jeans these days, of course, but at that time,
right,
everything that I loved were the rejects of America. They were the things that the establishment actually didn't want people to really recognize. For me, they were the great things about America.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, that a soul he said. Then the loud sound, it seemed to fade. Came back like a slow voice on a wave of fade. That weren't no DJ, that was hazy. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it. Let the children use it. Let all the children boogie.
Switch on the TV, we may pick him up on channel 2. but it was another of the first generation of American rock and rollers that came to mind immediately when David Bowie appeared on his 1971 album cover, The Man Who Sold the World, wearing a dress. Not since Little Richard had a rocker projected such ambiguity in sexuality. Here's the Spiders band leader, the late guitarist Mick Ronson.
While we're still playing duets, we got into wearing dresses, and we'd wear dresses on stage and start using a lot of makeup and stuff, you know. And then from there, it went into more of a, like, it was kind of a rock band, but as Ziggy was getting put together, then the ideas of the costumes still kept coming, so it developed into some other area, you know. He was always, like, you know, like, kind of fashion conscious and setting trends, and Angela had a lot to do with that, Angela Bowie, you know, because she was real sort of outgoing like that, and she was, like, all for, like, dressing up and being real flamboyant and everything, you know. The dress sense was always there, you know. It just kind of went through different stages. I mean, David had come floating around in a dress, you know, like, in the middle of the afternoon, like, for no reason, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, like, what the hell is going on here, you know? I mean, you would, you know, I mean, like, I'm a Yorkshire man, you know what I mean? I'm from the north of England, you know? It's like, you know, it was really, I really enjoyed dressing up too, you know, and everything. But I mean, then it got like, you know, you dress up before you go on stage, you dress up to go on stage and stuff, you know what I mean? But then it just become a whole daily life, you know?
David Bowie credits the father of another London musician who would later go on to rewrite the record books with setting David on a free-thinking creative course.
His father was my art master. Peter Frampton's father, Professor Frampton, was he got me into the artistic mode at a very young age. He was great. He was a terrific man. Incredibly inspirational and a real help in the bleakness of a useless academic life. There was some spark of hope with Frampton Senior. And because of him, I guess, he really gave me the option that one can sort of have a creative career. It wouldn't have to be sort of, you know, I thought like the rest of the people that lived around me and the guys that I knew, it would be some kind of real blue collar job, which is fine, which is okay. I just didn't want one. That's it. It's as simple as that. And he did show me that there was a way of sort of turning an artistic side into some kind of career. And initially I thought I was either going to be a painter, but I realised there was absolutely no money in that. So for work, I became a graphics artist, a commercial artist. And that was going on parallel to me playing in R&B bands in the evenings. In the evenings, I'd sort of dodge back to my apartment, grab my saxophone, because I was playing saxophone then, and go out and play R&B.
Come on.
Hang On to Yourself. From David Bowie's 1972 classic Ziggy Stardust, guitarist Mick Ronson came up with a memorable fluid slide there.
And I'm a very sort of electric player too, you know. I'm not a very clever player or anything. I mean, if I hit a chord, I really want to hit it as hard as, you know, I mean, I really like mean to hit that chord, you know. I don't like playing about with it. And when I play a guitar, I really like to play the thing from the heart or something, you know. Otherwise, I don't think there's much point in playing it. We can always play like these nice little things and play like these nice little parts and stuff like that and put a bit of chorus in on it and make it sound real pretty. You know what I mean? I always thought Pete Townsend was the greatest rhythm guitar player ever, you know, because of the way he hits them chords. I mean, when that guy hit that guitar, he hit that thing. I mean, no missing, you know. And that, to me, was like fantastic, you know. That's, to me, is how you should play guitar, you know. I don't piddle around with a thing, you know. Get all of it and play it, you know. It's like Jimi Hendrix did the same thing. And that's how I wanted to play guitar. I wanted to play it like, there's no mistaking. Here I'm playing guitar, you know. Not sit there all studiously, you know what I mean? Playing all these nice little things, you know. I mean, I kind of, you know, I like to hit the thing, you know.
Played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang, screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo. Like some cat from Japan, he could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang. They came on so loaded, man, well hung in snow white tan. Time jiving us that we were voodoo. The kids were just crass, he was the Nas with God-given ass. He took it all too far, but boy could he play guitar. Making love with his ego, Ziggy's
In the song Ziggy Stardust, David Bowie sings, "Like some cat from Japan." Now, it's obvious from many of Bowie's publicity photos of the Ziggy period, where he's wearing kimonos, very glamorous, adorned with large Japanese lettering, that David Bowie had some interest in Far East culture. I asked him which of his Buddhist philosophies have stuck with him over the years.
I tell you, the one thing that did stay with me over all these years, was the underlying theme of transition, and the ability to let go of things, that nothing in our lives lasts, nothing manifest lasts, except our spirit. And I think that that sort of really affected me as a juvenile, and it never really left my way of looking at things. I find it very easy to let go of things. I let go of the past, physical things, stuff. I don't hold on to that much. Some people put it down to carelessness, and they may well be right. But I think a lot of it is actual sort of... it doesn't bother me if it's not there.
That's
except sex, of course. but I mean, you know, God and sex, those are the only two things to worth worrying about, really, aren't they?
Yes. Some people
feel... Well, maybe a good pair of trousers.
A good pair of trousers.
And shoes. Well, actually, while we're on the subject, there's quite a few things.
A whole wardrobe.
And the car to drive around them, of course. Yes, you've got to park the car somewhere, so it brings you to houses. Yeah. I guess everything I said is wrong.
Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit inthestudio.net for many more exclusive interviews and live performances. I'm Redbeard with David Bowie and the late Mick Ronson. In the Studio, the iconic The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Hi, this is David Bowie, and I'm in the studio for The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Thanks again, David. I'm Redbeard on the anniversary of this Ziggy Stardust album. Rock writer Rob Sheffield noted, and I quote, "With Ziggy Stardust, Bowie reinvented himself as glitter-rocking star child, composing an 11-song operetta on the subject of rock star as isolated artist," end quote. We know that Ziggy's was the name of a London tailor shop that David spotted from the window of a train. Stardust was nicked from a country singer who called himself the legendary Stardust Cowboy and innocently appeared in earnest on American television, but the show's producers played him strictly for laughs. But there was an unforgettable real-life character from which David Bowie drew inspiration for Ziggy Stardust.
The most important ingredient in all this was a loony American called Vince Taylor.
Vince Taylor?
Vince Taylor was a would-be Elvis who didn't do so well in the States. So, yet again, he came over to England. It's the big fish, small pool syndrome. And he came over and tried to do a bit of an Elvis in Britain, and it didn't go down that well. So he ended up in France, where he became major and a contender to Johnny Hallyday for the title, in fact. While he was in England, I got to meet him, and I hung out with him. He was out of his tree.
Really?
What? The guy was genuinely deluded.
Really?
He would like wear white robes occasionally, and we'd be walking down really major streets in London, and then he would just stop and drag out a map of London and show me where all the Martians were going to land. And we'd be kneeling there in the middle of rush hour traffic, poring over maps and finding out where the saucers are going to land. And then Vince, so that was an introduction to a new way of looking at maps, as well as rock and roll. then Vince went to France and formed a rock band, but ended his career a few years later by coming on stage, again in his white robes, and declaring that he had finished in rock because he'd just been told he was Jesus Christ. And that was the end of Vince Taylor in France. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. I died a few years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, but you know, when you've got that Christ gig, you don't really need anything else.
You don't really need it, no. Although he did need a hospital at the end of his life to support his illusions.
Allusions.
Don't lean on me, man, 'cause you ain't got time to check it. No, my son.
Now, in 1972, David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust persona of alien hermaphrodite, simulating sex on stage, was shocking to some in America and perfectly scandalous fodder for the newspapers back in England. But Mick Ronson contended that it never eclipsed the musical merit.
No, it didn't get in the way of the music, no. It might have been as important as the music, but it never got in the way. The two things were kind of separated. But also, I think it maybe has some influence on some of the music, too, is because the way you dress, the way you feel, you know, can influence the way you write or the way you think or the way you perform. Do you know what I mean? There's kind of two go hand in hand somewhat. I mean, if you're dressed up looking like a plumber all your life, you maybe tend to play like that, too. I don't know, you know. I mean, it's very hard to say. But the way that you dress can influence the way you think. Because you feel different in different clothes, don't you? Everybody does.
And the reaction? Again, Mick Ronson.
People were really confused. I remember one gig we played. We had to leave the stage because all these girls were coming up with their high heels, stiletto heels, wanting to, like, kick the living daylights out of us, you know. Not everybody was going for it at all. Real mixed reaction. Like, thank God we got out of there alive. No. It never really lasted that long because I think we came to America for the first time. And once a lot of press got back to England from America, and I think once it started to get a lot in the press, it was much more acceptable. Before then, it wasn't that much in the press, so we'd turn up at these places and these people would go like, who the hell are these, you know? And it offended a lot of people. It really did, you know. It was really, really exciting, you know, first time we came here, you know. We didn't have, like, really full houses or anything either, you know. I mean, we played some Coliseum dates, you know. There'd be like 200 people in the audience, you know. The turning point was after the press got back to England, we'd been playing all these stadiums. Whether there was 100 people there or not, it didn't matter. And as far as England was concerned, we was playing stadiums. So when we went back to England, we was the biggest thing since sliced bread. The funny thing is, we never sold that many records. It was a real underground thing, you know.
It was then that David Bowie established a long tradition that continues to this day. Bowie's keen eye and ear for developing talent in others.
Yeah, I think it's because I'm the perennial fan. I'm just such a fan of music. That plus I have great taste, of course. Mainly, you can put it down. When I hear something good, it just turns me on so much. I get so excited about it. I just want to work with these guys. You know, when you hear somebody playing so brilliantly, some gift they've been given, you think, oh God, I'd love to work with that guy. If there's anything that I do, I don't know, I suppose the only thing would be to ask them themselves. Maybe the thing that I do that they wouldn't necessarily find working with other musicians is that I give them probably a greater area of freedom. And I tend to throw in references that are not always about music. I kind of expand the consciousness of whatever we're doing in a certain way, by keeping it not quite so linear as maybe it would be if they're working on a jam session. I rarely let guys improvise in quite that traditional manner. I'll always get them to picture that they're playing in another continent, that they're working with. I'll come up with some strange personalities that they've got to compete with, for instance. I mean, a good example is when I work with, say, Robert Fripp. On the Heroes, on the Scary Monsters, more importantly, actually. On that album, I continually told him that he was on stage with B.B. King and had to prove his prowess against B.B. King. So he had that as a kind of an unconscious image while he was playing, and it made him play in a particularly aggressive fashion. You could almost hear that he was like, he knew he had to compete against this legend. Maybe explore, you know, some interesting ideas that they may not have come across at the time. I don't know. I might be being immodest about it, but I feel that maybe is the way that I work best with other musicians. I try and pull something out of them that maybe they're not aware of.
I'm an alligator. I'm a mama, papa, calling for you. I'm a space invader. I'll be your rock and roll that makes me go. Your mouth so hard. You're squawking like a big monkey bird. Busting up my brains for the words. Keep your head too high or be baby. Put your break onto my head. Raise your
fake it, baby. Lay the real thing on me. You know the Church of Man, love is such a holy place to be. Don't fake it, baby. Make me know you really care. Make me jump into it, yeah. Spice close to my love. Freak out in the moonlight starting. Oh yeah, oh.
To paraphrase Lou Reed, between thought and expression, that's the territory that David Bowie's genius inhabits. With David Bowie, it's not necessarily what he says artistically, but how he says it and what he means when he does. Bowie's second album, Man of Words, Man of Music, retitled when it was reissued in 1972 as Space Oddity, was released at the dawn of the 1970s, a decade which David himself has called the beginning of the 21st century.
For me, as a member of society, I think for me it felt like an era, a decade when absolutes were breaking down. There was the feeling that things were pluralistic, that the hard and fast rules that we'd sort of, that the spin of the 50s where everything was answerable, where there was good, there was bad, there was negative, there was positive, that everything was easy to quantify and easy to put into categories, broke down in the 70s. There was suddenly a feeling that there were at least two sides to every question. There was ambiguity actually became part of society. The whole sexual revolution really reached a point in the 70s where nothing was seen as being quite so clear and straightforward as it was
true.
Before.
That's a good point.
Everything started to, the beginning of the recognition that we live in chaos really started in the 70s. I think the Nixon and the Vietnam conclusion at that point, that the duplicity of what war was all about really came home more than at any other time during that period.
Sure it came.
It really felt like a new century.
With June 1972 Ziggy Stardust release, to paraphrase Bob Dylan, the times they had a change, and no one knew that better than David Bowie.
The 60s were a coda to the rest of the century. There was like the questions were raised then, I think, in the 60s. But still, there was a kind of an idealism, which in itself had its own absolutes and its own belief that there was an answer to particular things. And I think the 70s showed conclusively that we live on a thread of rationality, that in fact the cosmos is far more complex and non-understandable than we had ever perceived before, that everything we knew was wrong.
Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth. You pull on your finger, then another finger, then cigarette. The water wall is calling, it lingers, then you forget. Oh, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. You're too old to lose it, too young to choose it. And the clock waits so patiently on your song. You walk past the cafe, but you don't eat when you've lived too long. Oh, no, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. Shift break the snarling as you stumble across the road. But the day breaks instead, so you hurry home. Don't let the sun blast your shadow. Don't let the milk float rob your mind. They're so natural, religiously unkind. Oh no, love, you're not alone. You're watching yourself, but you're too unfair. Right.
The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. May God rest the souls of David Bowie and Mick Ronson. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests David Bowie and Mick Ronson for what now is precious, precious memories. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2017, all rights reserved, transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, and for performances and the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net.